Hello, and welcome to Behind the Biology, brought to you by ATCC. I'm your host, Dave Yarmush, and this is our first episode in our series with Dr. Jesse Boehm. Dr. Boehm has a history of researching and working towards genomics-oriented resolution to various cancers. From the Broad Institute to the Breakthrough Cancer Foundation, he's passionately driving toward new frontiers using new technologies such as organoids, single-cell genomics, and CRISPR. Today, we'll be talking about the details of his work. Welcome, Jesse. How are you doing today? Thanks for joining us.
Great, David. Thank you so much for having me. This is a great invitation.
Excellent to have you. So we can get right to it. You were with the Broad Institute for about 15 years, right? You extensively work in assorted cancer genomics and cancer treatments. Part of that was the Cancer Dependency Map Initiative, and I did a little digging into that. It's very interesting. Can you talk about it? Because you probably can better than I can.
Yeah, no, the work at the Broad is so collaborative and interdisciplinary. I think we tried to look for things that would really drive the field of cancer forward and to try to create solutions that could benefit the whole scientific community and to benefit patients. And one of those was really the inability to predict the appropriate dependencies or Achilles heels of a given cancer based on its molecular information. You think that you could sequence a tumor and a clinician could make those predictions for a given patient, but that the interpretability of that information just isn't where we need it to be as a field. And you can't just take all patients on the planet and randomly assort them to all possible cancer therapies. There's not enough therapies. You can't do that type of trial ethically. And there are many additional targets that are emerging. And so the hypothesis about 10 years ago was that you could do that experiment in the lab as part of an initiative called the Cancer Dependency Map Initiative that started at the Broad Institute and the Sanger Institute and became kind of an international collaboration to take cell lines and organoids and preclinical models from every type of cancer to grow them in the laboratory in kind of petri dishes and systematically perturb them with CRISPR, cutting every single gene in the genome, and with as many drugs as possible, many of which had been approved for other types of cancers or even other diseases, and to systematically test every type of cancer against every type of therapy or possible drug target in the lab and to look for what the Achilles heels were based on those cells dying. And to do that over and over systematically and to create a map. And from that map, to be able to look up which molecular information was related to which vulnerability. So that was the dependency map. It was wonderful to be involved with that over many years. And we kind of grew that from a fledgling idea to a multi-lab, multi-institutional, international type of effort. And now over 1,200 genome-wide CRISPR screens has been completed. This cancer cell line encyclopedia, which began with about 900 or 1,000 cell models, has grown to almost sort of 3,000. The molecular characterization is far deeper than it ever was. And there are many clinical trials and new therapeutics that are now being developed because of this initiative. So I think it's a great example of what can be done collaboratively across organizations in the preclinical space. And I know that speaks quite a bit to what ATCC is all about as well.
Thank you. I want to come back to the collaboration aspect of it, but the advantage of the Dependency Map Initiative, the program you worked with and have helped put together, like you said, you can't just try every drug on every patient and see what works. And not only because the cancers are going to be different and they're going to respond differently, but it's going to overwhelm the patient's system, right? Everyone is well aware of how taxing chemotherapy is, for instance. Or hopefully everyone's well aware of that. But if you can take the tumors and put them on a chip or make an organoid, produce an organoid from them, or several, as it were, now you can try them all serially, right? So now, is that the point?
I think that's the idea. It used to be that, you know, only about 1% of tumors, when you tried to grow them in the lab, you know, would actually turn into one of these cellular models and kind of grow so you could perturb it and sort of study it. And so, you know, 20, 30 years ago, many of the cell models we had of cancer weren't necessarily representative of all of the genomic features of tumors that we now know exist, all of the cellular states at the transcriptional level that we know exist, and certainly weren't reflective of some of the 3D architecture that we know tumors utilize, the kind of how cells, you know, interact in a heterotypic manner. But just about 10 years ago, a new set of technologies began to emerge that allowed almost 40% of human tumors to be grown in the lab as new types of cell lines or organoids or neurosphere models. And the cell, the media recipes, you know, what food do you need to give these things to, you know, keep them alive in the lab for long periods of time? And how do you monitor that what you're growing out actually recapitulates the human tumor and kind of keep it stable? I think those technologies began to emerge from a number of labs, and we and many others put those through their paces. And so rather than the dependency map activity only utilizing historical cell lines, it has begun to continually use more and more of these new patient-derived models. And I think that, for me, that's exciting because it means that the gap between patient-based research and cell model-based research is shrinking. And one of the things we're trying to do now is to make that timing of perturbation really, really close to the patient, maybe even within the first month or within the first week. And if we can get there, that'll be a really exciting moment for the precision medicine field.
So you also said that you're using CRISPR to deactivate these genes, you know, one by one, sort of searching through them independently. And I've just been kind of curious reading about this. Is this also sort of oriented towards like a drug discovery program? Is there any consideration towards that, right? If you can target this section of a gene when disrupted, you know, reduces the efficacy or the growth potential of this tumor cell, is it then identify now a drug that can do that less than it is, can an existing drug apply to this? More is it, I'm thinking, can we find a new drug or design a drug
That's exactly the point. I think many of us cancer researchers sort of assume we have most of the drugs we need to target most of the cellular processes. But if you look at kind of the armamentarium of what cancer drugs exist, there are only a few hundred, and they, you know, kind of target similar families of cancer targets, kinases and receptors and signaling proteins, quite a bit. Now that's changing, of course, with new types of chemistries and new approaches, but most of the genome has not really been systematically evaluated for being excellent therapeutic targets in particular classes. So that's what CRISPR obviously allows us to do, is to use, you know, this precise molecular scissors and kind of go one by one and snip each gene, and then cells or organoids in which that gene was cut in half and deactivated that can't survive without it, they stop growing and they get depleted from the population. And so CRISPR allows us to emulate what a drug might do without actually having to build that drug. And most of the best targets that emerge are not druggable targets themselves. They're transcription factors, they're these master regulators of cell state, there are other signaling proteins. But the goal is to stimulate future therapeutic discovery programs. One of the, you know, more exciting projects or ideas that has come out of the dependency map was the discovery of a helicase protein, the Werner's helicase that kind of unwinds DNA. And the team at the Broad and the team at the Sanger and some companies independently discovered using this dependency map that in tumors that were microsatellite unstable, these MSI tumors, the cells could only divide when they had the activity of this Werner's helicase. But if you clipped the helicase gene, this Werner's helicase, in those cells, the cells died. And we didn't have a drug at the time against the Werner's helicase, but because four different groups independently identified the same new drug target and the same relationship with MSI in tumors, that stimulated many drug companies to begin developing drugs against Werner's helicase, and now some of the first drugs are in trial. So that's, I think, the beauty of preclinical modeling and of using CRISPR. It allows us to look in an unbiased way for what are the best drug targets.
And at that point, it sounds like the challenge is targeting the tumor cells and leaving the rest of the healthy cells alone. And there are presumably numerous biomarkers that'll help you do that. CRISPR's specificity, for example, would be directly applied.
I think, David, you've hit it on the head. I think, you know, cell lines aren't perfect and organoids aren't perfect. They're typically only the tumor cells. They're growing in a dish. We don't expect that those will unilaterally kind of recapitulate what happens in a patient, in a tumor or in the body, but they're a starting point. Once you discover a great therapeutic target, you need to evaluate what the toxicity profile might be of hitting that therapeutic target across multiple cell types across the body. And there are a few different ways of trying to get that information. I think one idea comes from the scale of the dependency map itself. Even though there are not normal cells and cancer cells, they're all cancer cells. When we can identify a particular target that has a relationship with a particular molecular feature that is only expressed in cancer cells and is only expressed in a subset of cancer cells, seeing that kind of bimodality in response, cells with it die when you hit the gene or test the drug, and cells without it don't die, that gives us some degree of confidence that a lot of the normal cells in the body that don't have that mutation also will not die when you hit that gene. So that's kind of one trick we use. The team also uses the GTEx database quite a bit to look at expression profiles and normal tissues. And obviously the whole field is now developing single cell atlases of gene expression states and mutations in healthy normal tissues. So I think the field is going to get better and better with that over the years, but there is always the concern that there will be fake outs from these cell model type of experiments. But we think that the right place to start is to nominate great drug hypotheses, because more successes we think will come from this type of project than from kind of classical, you know, scientific empiricism.
I think it stands to reason. You mentioned a couple times the collaborative nature of the work. You said Sanger, a handful of other companies, obviously Broad, which itself is a collaboration, MIT and Harvard. How is that coming into play these days for cancer research in general, for cancer therapeutics?
Yeah, it's such an amazing time to kind of launch your career, or even like me, be, you know, mid-career in cancer. I think before the Human Genome Project, you know, early in the 1990s or even in the early 2000s, it sort of seemed like the stuff that was needed to be done to solve cancer's greatest challenges, you know, could be done one lab at a time. I think the Genome Project in 2001, the sequencing of cancer genomes starting in like 2008, 2009, and scaling up, and many large-scale projects since, have showed us that we need to do both. We need to do basic research that's one lab at a time, but increasingly we need to take on cancer at a macro level in large, collaborative, interinstitutional, sometimes industrial scale operations that really approach cancer systematically and to engineer serious solutions. And those aren't a great fit for the one lab at a time approach. And so I kind of became interested early on in my graduate years at the idea that multiple labs could kind of work together. And even though that wasn't universally seen by some of my, you know, grad school colleagues, it seemed exciting that maybe there was latent energy in the system that could be unlocked by helping people work together. And I think that's something that I began to appreciate in the Broad environment, that Harvard and MIT and the cancer program at the Broad was 40 labs and everyone's working together. It's kind of messy, but actually it's a safe space where people can interact and launch big projects. I think since then I've moved and I'm now the CSO of this new foundation called Breakthrough Cancer, and we're trying to stimulate teams across major cancer centers across the United States to work collaboratively across organizations to do things together that they could not do otherwise. So I've always kind of described myself as a bit of a, you know, collaboration evangelist. You know, how do you make collaboration work? How do you solve the problems? Which challenges are people-oriented and kind of anthropological, which are scientific and technological, which are bureaucracy and paperwork, and which ones are incentives? I've tried to sort of study the system and have really been convinced that it's possible and in fact desirable to grow one's career focused on solving big problems and building big collaborations. And I think the dependency map was a great example of that. Multiple academic organizations, 20 companies, et cetera, working together. I organized a rare cancer initiative with 15 foundations and multiple funding partners to tackle rare cancers systematically across disease foundations. And now, as I mentioned, Breakthrough Cancer is yet another example of that. So I think when the conditions are right, most scientists and most organizations desperately want to work together, because that's the right thing to do to solve the problem for patients. It's just that the system of cancer research today doesn't necessarily support that or encourage that. But I'm trying to create conditions where more and more scientists can pursue that passion.
If I were to speculate, having not worked in cancer space, but being a scientist, one of the historical challenges for interlab collaboration, institution, international, what have you, one of the major challenges are just generally logistical, right? It's how do you get the people in the room and able to communicate in a timely fashion? How do you share information, especially, you work in genomic sequencing, those data footprints get enormous in a, no time, right? It takes nothing to start producing terabytes of data. From what I can gather, Breakthrough Cancer is heavily invested in answering exactly that problem. You can even consider the bureaucratic component if you're going to be applying for grant money, which is unfortunately a difficulty for everyone. When you apply for grant money, you need to now justify everybody on the grant, right? And I'm sure that's not necessarily any different, but Breakthrough Cancer, you are a funding vehicle yourself. Is that right?
Yes, that's exactly right. And funders, I think, have a special opportunity to not just provide dollars, but to support creating the conditions to attract talent and drive science forward, in the appropriate way. And so we take that responsibility seriously.
And I would imagine that in a recent decade or two, the advancements in obviously data storage and transfer protocols, sorry, bioinformatics, I think in data all the time. Equivalently, or maybe even more importantly, we're doing this across teams. This is a live video stream where we're seeing no lag, no delay. I have to imagine that those advancements have made the approaches you're taking even more viable than they could have been 15, 20 years ago.
I think that's exactly right. I think many of the conditions are present, but look, collaboration, real collaboration, not just the fake type that's out there that some scientists will say they're collaborating, but really just, divide up some money and do different things and tell a funder once in a while they're really working together. I think real, genuine collaboration is a relationship. It's built on trust. It's built on a shared experience and a shared passion and an audacity to have a vision that's bigger than either set of individuals or institutions and to pursue something together. This is how NASA and the Jet Propulsion Lab, thinks about its missions. You want to go to Mars. You don't do that one person at a time. You build a team, a cross-functional team. You have a mission, and you launch it into space by creating the conditions, attracting talent, and focusing on solving a problem and working together. I think the cancer system just isn't set up that way because there's a lot of competition for the same sort of activities, but for the same grant money. But like you're describing, I think there's a series of opportunities that provide this kind of moment of convergence. There's the opportunities that data science and data sharing and data aggregation, I think, now support for cancer in the way that you've described. That isn't to say that it's easy, but those do support the notion that by converging information across organizations, you can do things that were not done sort of separately. Social media and technology and Zoom calls and Slack and Teams and all of these, platforms for collaboration obviously make things a bit easier. And then I think, to be frank, I think the pandemic and other types of catastrophic world events that we continue to witness, I think force us to reflect on what we're really trying to do here as scientists and what changes we're really trying to evoke on the world. And the, Operation Warp Speed, which is, always an analogy that people use for everything, actually, did show us that you can take a bunch of infectious disease researchers across public-private boundaries and utilize governmental influence and utilizing the urgency of the moment and actually create a workforce and a set of imperatives to solve an entrenched problem that would have ordinarily taken a decade to solve and do that really quickly. So I think my greatest fear is that we, as cancer researchers, don't learn from that experience and kind of go back to what we were doing before. It's the same number of people die each day from cancer in the United States as did at the peak of the pandemic. There should be the same level of urgency day in and day out than we felt when, you know, we were home with our masks on at our Zoom calls, you know, facing that experience personally. Cancer patients demand that, and families demand that. Why are researchers not working together? Why are researchers not sharing and exchanging? So they feel that urgency, and we should as well. So I think the pandemic and world events provide a key catalyst for thinking about the field differently. Technology, both collaboration technology and data science technology and other technologies, I think provide a unique opportunity to do really big things together. And you can really see how the field is shifting. You can see national commitments like ARPA-H and the Cancer Moonshot and the types of things we're trying to do at Breakthrough Cancer, try to create structural reforms for cancer at the national level. And I think it's only a matter of time before more and more of us are part of multidisciplinary interinstitutional teams. And that's kind of what being a cancer researcher, you know, is going to be like in 10 or 20 years. And so the question is which organizations want to push and drive the field forward in that direction, and which kind of want to sit back and wait for others to kind of pave the way. I very much want to help drive that revolution forward, just because I see the importance of its value, and really, you know, don't think that there's any time to wait to benefit patients.
And so at the frontier of the cancer research, you've said it a couple of times, precision genomics, you've called it, or precision treatment. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit? I know you've mentioned it's about growing up tumor cells and altering them and editing them, but is there more to it?
Yeah, you know, precision medicine obviously emerged as kind of an antidote to clinical empiricism, you know, test some drugs and see what works. I think precision medicine was the idea and is the idea that the key information for drug targeting is encoded in the molecular profile of the tumor, and going after that with a targeted therapy or an immunotherapy or a chemotherapy and having that actually work. I think the challenge is that only about 25% of patients benefit from, you know, molecular information-based precision medicine today. We just can't interpret the genomes or the transcriptomes of most patients with regards to the dependencies. So I talked about the dependency map as being a piece of a functional genomic type of solution to that, a reference set of information to do that really well. And now what's happening when we have a tumor in front of us, we're beginning to be able to look up in the dependency map, sequence the tumor, sequence the genomics of that tumor, look up in the dependency map and say, you know what, there are actually probably 15 possible therapeutic hypotheses that might actually work for this patient's tumor. But we think we need a second set of technologies to actually test those hypotheses directly in those patient cells. And we call that precision functional genomics, growing those cells really, really quickly, testing either on organoids or now actually in the first week of culture, testing drugs or CRISPRs, looking at a cell-by-cell level in a heterogeneous tumor sample, which cell is which and how is it responding to the therapy, and to validate or invalidate the predictions that come from the dependency map. So we think this whole arc of functional genomics applied to patient samples from tumors is a precision functional genomics axis that's emerging. And precision functional genomics, together with what's currently thought of as precision medicine sequencing, we think that's going to be a big part of how we get precision medicine to as many patients as possible in the decade ahead. And our lab is trying to build some new technologies to do that better and better.
That's great. I'm curious, because you touched on something that I work with, although on the microbial level. When you do that precision genomics, the sequencing aspect of it, I trust that you're characterizing the mutations that become now evident and build out, maybe not a molecular profile, but a genomic profile of any given tumor. How deeply do you need to sequence for human genomics at that level?
Yeah, you know, it's challenging. Tumors are complex. And if you look at a phylogenetic, you know, tree of the many branches and many subclones of a given tumor, you might be confused and you might think, oh, this is just so complicated. We're never going to be able to take down, you know, all of those branches. I think many of us feel that, though, while there is a lot of complexity, the truncal mutations or the truncal cellular states, the states and the mutations that are present at the very beginning of the tumor's evolution that are there in essentially all of the tumor cells are really the ones that if you could figure out how to target, you know, you would take down the whole tree. You would kind of take down the whole tumor. So one needs to sequence deeply to analyze the biology and the evolution of the tumor as it's evolving. But one might not need to sequence as deeply as that to identify the most important mutations that are so-called truncal that we think are going to be the right ones to kind of go after therapeutically. I think what's more important than sequencing deeply is continuing to profile the tumor longitudinally. The tumor is sequenced and then a therapy is given and that tumor evolves. You want to reevaluate the molecular landscape of that tumor soon after. And then several months later, it might have evolved a bit more. So I think what's happening more and more, both in the lab, both in cell lines and organoids, as well as in patients, is the best science is being done as the samples are being profiled longitudinally over time. And you can get a real-time glimpse of exactly what's happening at the molecular level. And that's only been possible now because sequencing technologies and single-cell genomics technologies are dropping in cost and are being more democratically accessible to more and more researchers and eventually more and more patients. And I think that temporal longitudinal sampling is going to give us the best information. So that would be my encouragement to listeners, is to think about assessing complexity across that time axis.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think it would be a mistake to assume that your environment now is the same as it is in a year, in 3 years, in 7 years, and so forth. I think we're about up for time on this episode. Before I let you go, I like the phrase you said, the democracy of sequencing. And you mentioned that in reference to the cost decreasing. I think that also would apply to the CRISPR technology as well. Right, is the idea of democratizing, quote unquote, in this context, that cost and accessibility are both going in, let's say, a positive direction, for lack of a better word, and it's such that not only can high profile laboratories, highly funded laboratories, achieve the kind of experiments that require these technologies, but now smaller ones, smaller academic institutions, nonprofits, and so forth. And then is the experimental design any simpler as a consequence as well?
I think that's exactly the case, David. We just can't have a system where you have to be a rich institution or a rich laboratory to do the world's best science. I think CRISPR gives you the potential to do, I used to say, and I still say, what one graduate student can do in like 1 week with CRISPR is what it used to take, 50 scientists to do over the course of many years. And so the accessibility of genome engineering technologies, their simplicity of use, and their incredible power is, I think, one type of democratization that's really exciting. I think the impetus and the encouragement to create resources for the public good, large collections of organoids and cell models, like what we've done with the NCI and ATCC as part of the Human Cancer Models Initiative, collections of CRISPR, reagents and others that are democratically shared by distributors such as, Adgene and others. I think these are ways that now kind of any laboratory can get their hands on some of the best validated, world-class, technologies and resources. And then data sets also. You mentioned Revolution Data Science. I mean, you can just go to the NCI's Genomic Data Commons or cBio portal, and you can click a button and for free kind of get access to thousands of genome sequencing and sequences and kind of evaluate any hypothesis. So there's never been a better time to kind of be an underfunded lab, because you can really have a tremendous amount of power. And actually the greatest hypotheses are really sitting there within the data sets ready to be plucked and validated by the lab in the country that has the most expertise kind of in that gene or in that subspecialty. So it's a great moment for the field in both large-scale science and also very focused investigator-driven science. I think it's a false distinction that one has to dominate the other. I think the moment in time is really lifting all boats, and I think that is exciting from a field perspective, and it's also exciting from a access and democracy kind of perspective at enabling everyone, regardless of their background or the lab's wealth or their own personal economy, to kind of get involved with cancer science. It's very exciting.
Yeah, it must even be just great from your own personal interest in that level of collaboration.
Yeah. The best ideas come from someone who has not been anchored to thinking about the problem for a long period of time. It's a young person who was trained in a different discipline, or it's someone from a different part of the country or a different part of the world that has grown up in a different environment that has different perspectives, or it's someone that has crossed fields, that they're a physicist and now they're kind of thinking about cancer biology. I think what's exciting is when you can kind of unleash the creative potential of these kind of cross-cutting individuals and, you know, enable them to ask questions in new ways on new data sets. And you can really only do that if you make a commitment to sharing data, make a commitment to training, a commitment to the user interfaces that support interaction. And frankly, the scientists and the teams and the institutions have to be committed to that as well. It is not cheap to share data. It's not free.
Right.
It's not cheap to train the next generation of researchers. It's not cheap to have a full concierge desk that answers questions about data sets online or in person. But these are things that I think mature teams and researchers need to do and funders need to take stock of, because these are the ways that the whole field and the whole nation and the whole world can really benefit as much as possible. We're trying to do that as much as possible at Breakthrough Cancer, and we're trying to challenge other funders to invest in infrastructure and training and support and those types of things in exactly the same way as they try to invest in the most exciting, you know, new scientific idea. We want to make, you know, infrastructural investment sexy, and we, you know, try our best to do that.
Well, that's music to my ears. I think that's what we've got for the time right now. Jesse, thank you so much. And we'll talk again.
Great, David. Thanks so much for having me again. It was great talking with you.
Over the past few decades, research in cancer therapeutics has begun interrogating patient-specific treatments. The use of organoids is just the beginning, as while they offer tissue-specific in vitro controlled studies, they don't quite emulate larger systems, and CRISPR's targeting could be misunderstood. However, Dr. Jesse Boehm is involved in the construction of such systems with teams united by Breakthrough Cancer, as he works through bureaucracy and takes a longitudinal approach to researching individual tumors. In the next episode, we'll discuss where his passion for this comes from.